Investigative journalist Hamish McDonald is a well-known commentator on foreign affairs and defence, but for 30 years, one story in particular has preoccupied him. When working in Japan in the 1980s, Hamish was given a box of papers containing a large manuscript that detailed the life of Charles Barbier. Swiss-born but left by his merchant father to be raised by a Japanese mistress in Yokohama, Charles Barbier had a totally Japanese upbringing. He wanted to be a soldier, but due to his heritage, couldn't enlist in the Japanese military. So he ended up fighting with the Australians at Gallipoli, working with British intelligence in Singapore in the 1930s, and then, during World War II, devising Allied propaganda directed at Japanese troops, encouraging thousands of Japanese soldiers to surrender. Hamish McDonald has now completed the story of this remarkable life in a book called A War of Words.
Hello.
A pile of photographs and a manuscript handed over to you by a fellow journalist. And the first character is Charles Barbier, the illegitimate son of a Swiss businessman. But unlike the Madame Butterfly plot, the foreigner left the child with the Japanese mistress who raised him. Tell us about Charles. He was, other than in his actual ethnicity, a thoroughly Japanese young man.
Yes, he was. His father was a big shot in Yokohama in the late 19th century, very rich from exporting silk to Europe. It was the biggest boom, equivalent to the China boom of now. He lived like a grandee, had a great Japanese semi-European mansion up on the heights above Yokohama. He had a Japanese mistress from his 20s when she was initially a teenager. But at some point, he also had a dalliance with a European woman and produced this boy, Charles Barbier, in 1888.
And what sort of a boy was he?
He was a rather lost boy, I think, because his father essentially dumped him with the Japanese mistress, who was more or less put into retirement with her own house and stipend down in the Japanese quarter of Yokohama. And the boy was raised by her.
And so there are pictures of a book of him in, you know, a tiny little boy, a tot, in Japanese dress. And he grows up, you describe it, to imagine a great life and a great identity for himself. What did he imagine himself into?
Well, he grew up in the heyday of Japan's military expansion, the late Meiji period, when they humiliated the Chinese in 1895 and then went on to humiliate the Russians in 1905.
And so he aspired to be a warrior?
He did indeed. I mean, where he was in Yokohama was the departure point for a lot of the naval forces and soldiers going off to fight these wars. And he just loved the military glory and fantasized about being a great soldier himself. His father had sent out toys from Europe, the little toy swords and a rocking horse and so on, and he, you know, from an early age, it was part of the dream.
And so the dream, and this is one of the most fascinating twists of the book, is fulfilled not in Japan, but on the beaches of Gallipoli.
Yes, he'd been wandering the world. He'd set off when he turned about 20 and his Japanese foster mother died, leaving him a little bit of money. He set off towards Europe via China to find his father. Well, he got as far as China, then got embroiled in the 1911 Chinese Revolution, and then while in Shanghai in 1912, saw a note in one of the English language papers there that the Australian Army, the new Australian Army, was looking for officer candidates. So he promptly packed his bags and took a steamer down to Melbourne and set about qualifying to become a British subject, which required 2 years residency. Now, that was up just as World War I broke out. The officer recruitment stopped, but he signed up as a private soldier and was sent out in the second great reinforcement to Egypt in early 1915. And then became part of the second wave that went into Gallipoli in August 1915.
And tell me what happened to him at Gallipoli.
Well, he was a sergeant by then and he had a platoon of soldiers in the 23rd Battalion. They went up to relieve the soldiers who'd fought the bitter battles at Lone Pine, only 40 yards or so from the Turkish front lines. He was up there for 3 weeks. His English was rather stilted, and as part of his military fantasies, he'd kept a copy of all these great war manuals, including von Clausewitz, the Prussian military strategist.
How did he put those to use?
Well, he would read them in the trenches, and obviously he gained a bit of a reputation as being rather strange, and a rumour went round that he was some kind of German spy or a Japanese spy or somebody alien. So he was getting pretty unpopular. And when he suffered a minor wound, when a bullet struck the periscope he was peering through and gashed him in the above one eye, his colonel decided to evacuate him and send him home.
This is RN Breakfast. I'm talking to journalist and author Hamish McDonald about his new book on the life of Charles Barbier called A War of Words. There was a fascinating point in the book where Charles was in Singapore, found his way to Singapore before Singapore fell in the Second World War, and he was actually able to get up to Thailand and get himself into, what, a drinking session with a Japanese commander and figure out what their plans were in terms of invasion of Singapore. How did he do that?
Well, this is actually one of the chapters where I had to bridge the known facts. I know that he went on a secret mission to Upper Malaya and into Thailand in 1938.
On whose behalf?
On behalf of MI5, the British Intelligence Service.
What did he figure out?
He came back, according to reports in British archives, with a full plan of how the Japanese were going to take Singapore with the landings in Malaya and the northeast coast of Malaya and through Thailand. And it was all laid out. MI5 sent this to London and were told, don't be silly and don't let this kind of thinking get out. It would damage morale in Singapore and alarm the population. They ignored it, and it was only in the last few weeks that they started seriously reinforcing Singapore on the landward side.
And from there he made his way back to Australia. I mean, one can only imagine totally disillusioned with his efforts to contribute to the war effort on the Allied side, and yet he continues with a career almost in propaganda.
Yes, well, all personnel involved in intelligence were evacuated, some to India and some initially to the Dutch East Indies. And then when that was crumbling, they were put on small ships and sent down to Australia, where several of them regrouped in Melbourne in mid-1942 and formed this little-known a propaganda outfit called the Far Eastern Liaison Office, which started a psychological warfare campaign against the Japanese.
And there were always questions all through his life about who he was and the divided loyalties and where he belonged. He was very useful to Australia, you write, in the Second World War, writing propaganda to be delivered to the Japanese and the front lines in the Pacific. How many lives do you think he saved doing that?
Oh, well, the record of surrenders and willing captures in the Southwest Pacific Theatre was of about 4,000 Japanese soldiers.
And how much of that was down to Charles?
I think he played a large part in devising the leaflets and propaganda messages that encouraged some Japanese to accept that they could surrender without being shot out of hand or tortured, as their officers assured them they would be.
Mm. You write that he was better at this than any American-born Japanese, that he had a unique skill at this. What was it?
Well, he was essentially a Japanese in a white skin, whereas they, these descendants of the sugarcane workers and others in Hawaii and people in the West Coast, were already Americans in a Japanese skin.
And so he understood the idea of honour and of dying for honour, and he was able to devise almost psychological tactics to get around that, to allow them to surrender with honour.
Yes, they didn't use the word surrender. It was cease resistance, for example.
And that was an important distinction?
It was. It avoided the real no-no of the Japanese military code. Another thing he insisted they do was not to insult the emperor, which a lot of early propaganda did. So it became a lot more subtle and an appeal to a deeper loyalty and to ties of home. They had a kind of stream of propaganda that they called nostalgia, which showed the rice being harvested and what was going on at home.
Mm.
And he made references to Japanese writing, literature and so on, contemporary literature, including a popular series about a blind samurai.
Right.
So you
know, he could really get under their skin.
He certainly did.
You write about when you delve through that box, seeing that Charles had sons fighting on either side of that Pacific War, and that in itself is a fascinating story, that next generation. What did you conclude about Charles in terms of where he really felt he belonged?
I think he belonged in Japan, and he went back there. He was widowed in 1947. His first Japanese wife died in Singapore when he was back there helping the war crimes tribunals. And I think he realized he didn't belong anywhere else but back in Japan. So he long abandoned hopes of finding his Swiss family. And really, he felt totally rejected by Australia. He'd had battles over citizenship and constant inquiries by the forerunner of ASIO, the security service. And he walked away from that and settled very happily back in Japan.
And so, finally, what do you conclude about him? What sort of figure should history record him as being?
I find him somebody who struggled, strove. I came to identify with him quite strongly. He really blew it and failed in just about all the big schemes that he attempted. He never became a great soldier. His career in the Australian Army was short and not very heroic. World War II, and before World War II in Malaya, he'd warned the British about how the Japanese planned to take Singapore. That was ignored. I just found him one of the kind of waifs of history who went through this incredible century and found himself at the centre of a lot of things.
One of life's great survivors.
A survivor, yeah. He had a lot of things that would have floored most people, but he lived to a great old age and really discovered himself and found, I think, the love of his life after he turned 60 and settled back and became quite a respected figure in Japan.
He's a fascinating figure and it's a wonderful book. Thank you so much for telling me about it.
Oh, pleasure.
Hamish McDonald, the author of the book A War of Words. Hamish will be speaking later this month at the Sydney Writers' Festival.